sculpture to wear. Not your everyday approach to jewelry. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I'm Chrissy Hewitt, and Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art. Co-host Stephen DeLuca and I produce this twice-monthly program for KCBX Public Radio. Our focus is the exploration of the visual arts. Today's guest is Marjorie Schick. I've known of this creator of jewelry and wearable sculpture since the early 80s, when I first attended an annual Society of North American Goldsmiths conference. Although not large in physical stature, Marjorie Schick was impossible not to notice. The clock purse, discussed later in this program, was an easy eye-catcher, but that was not the only part of the picture. There was color that moved with her. Her jewelry epitomized a growing trend of sculpture to wear. Admittedly, at the time, I understood next to nothing of this new trend of creating these large, colorful sculptures designed to adorn the body. What I did know was that this woman had presence. Besides her appearance, she always had several people walking with her, engaged in animated conversation. I was intrigued but too shy to engage beyond commenting on the clock purse. This summer, I decided it was time to learn her story. 7 years my senior, she sports short, cropped hair with a bright magenta highlight. Her sculpture to wear speaks colorfully against the dark hues of her clothing. To get a feel of this, I encourage those of you who might be near a computer to do a Google search for Marjorie Schick, S-C-H-I-C-K. So that you can follow along and see many of her creations. Her art has been shown internationally for several decades, and her inventive styles have led the way for many jewelers who have collectively expanded the definition of the discipline. Now, let's go to Tucson, Arizona. I am here with Marjorie Schick. Good afternoon.
Hello. It's such a pleasure to be with you today. It's pretty exciting having the opportunity to attend these SNAG meetings, Society of North American Goldsmiths, and these are great events, and I really enjoy the lectures, and I was just now watching one of some of the best of student work across the United States. It's so exciting, and so it's always a good learning experience to be at SNAG.
And you have good reason to be excited about student work because you have been teaching for a very long time, correct?
Yes, since 1967 at Pittsburgh State University. And I have loved my job and loved being with students and watching them develop. But now I'm of the age that my husband, who's a professor of American history also at Pittsburgh State University in Kansas, we both are going to start our next era of phased retirement, 5-year phased, which means 3 years at half time and then the last 2 years at quarter time. It seems like it's a very nice way to get into the idea of retirement, yeah. And I'm a quite messy person, and I have a bunch of things to deal with before I'm ever out of there without a trace.
Where in the rectangle is Pittsburgh, Kansas?
Well, in the rectangle, we're down in the very southeastern corner of the state. We're just 30 miles from Joplin, Missouri, that was hit when that horrible, horrible tornado.
And I'm sure more than one person has thought that you were in Pennsylvania.
I think that's happened. It's funny, our Pittsburgh has no H on the end. And, of course, that's not the only difference, right? We're a little town, right? But my husband, being an American historian and a friend, one evening got out the map of the United States and tracked. There are Pittsburghs pretty much all across to California. There's a Pittsburgh, California.
Right.
But it's a pretty area. I'll tell you that. It's pretty, slightly rolling and green.
So many, many years of teaching, but let's get back to what you've been teaching. But more importantly, how did you get started in working with metal or just as an artist?
Oh, well, my mother was an art teacher and an artist, and I was raised by my mother, and so I grew up with it, and I just knew when I was applying for college that I was going to be an art teacher, just like my mom. And so my undergraduate degree is from the University of Wisconsin. Well, I went to high school in Evanston, Illinois. Oh, I was lucky because every Saturday through high school, I took classes at the Chicago Art Institute for high school kids. Summers, too. So that, looking back, was an incredibly rich experience, you know. And then I went to the University of Wisconsin and got a BS in art education, knowing that I'd be an art teacher. And then, of course, met Jim, had done his undergraduate degree in history at the University of Wisconsin, and then a master's, and was going to go on for a PhD. So I said, oh, well, I think I'll go on for an advanced degree, too, because we were going to get married after finishing Wisconsin. So we applied to Indiana University, and naively, I didn't know anything really about the jewelry program except that my roommate at Wisconsin had taken a summer class from this woman named Eicherman, who used to leave the windows open so everybody could come in and work extra hours, right? That's all I knew. And that the jewelry that my roommate made was very different from what I'd been making. I'd been making things that were very flat. So I applied to Indiana, and I got this letter back. And it wasn't from Eicherman. It was from somebody else that said, "Dear Marjorie, your work is very ordinary, but we'll accept you anyway."
Oh, that is great.
So, well, we think it's great today, but...
And then, oh, I'm sure that then it must have felt really odd.
Well, I've had other things like that, too. I had a piece published in Art News one time, but it was upside down. So it's kind of like, well, you're accepted, but... I mean, it couldn't have worked out better for me. We went off to Indiana, and I met Professor Eicherman, and she changed my life, yeah. Because I'd watched my mother give her life over to teaching and being an artist, but then I watched Miss Eicherman do it, too, and I knew that that was what I wanted to do, and instead of aiming to teach it in high school, then when I graduated or was about to, I was applying to university jobs. She taught us aesthetics, and she taught us technique, and she taught us self-discipline. I worked like a dog. And what was neat for us all was that we had a little drawer in each of our desks. And in the top small drawer, it's a narrow one on a jewelry bench, we kept a piece of paper, and on it we had to write down every time we came into the studio to work and when we left. And she would go around and open those drawers and check to see. Plus, she was in there all the time, and on Saturdays as well. And we knew we'd better be there when the building unlocked on Saturday mornings and Sundays because she was checking. But that was good. That taught us what we had to do for the rest of our lives, really.
I love the description, you know, now in 2012, to hear somebody referring to your work as ordinary.
Well?
Because we're sitting here talking because you have made inroads, and it's anything but ordinary in terms of literally branching out with different materials, a lot of color, but you started with learning how to use silver.
Silver and brass and copper. Maybe some nickel. Eicherman was a metals person, and I didn't think about doing anything other than metal work. It was a 3-year program for the master's MFA. And at the end, though, after we graduated, a friend of mine from graduate school and her husband were then living in Iowa, and we drove to visit them one weekend from Lawrence. We were both teaching our first year out of school at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. And my friend Judy was doing paper mache. And Bud Stalnaker, who was one of the weaving instructors at Indiana, was having his craft students do paper mache bracelets. And in fact, he gave me one. He said, "You ought to try this." Well, I don't think I thought too much about it. And then my friend was doing paper mache, and she was covering hers with thread. And we got back to Lawrence, and There was this nice dress shop there, and I loved going there. We had our first paychecks, and I had bought a couple dresses, and one was a tiger print. And so I thought, oh, I'd make earrings out of paper mache to match my tiger print dress. They were big. I wore them, but I had to put monofilament over my head to support the weight of them. But that, I hadn't done paper mache since grade school. And acrylic paints, I think, were relatively new. And then there was the Six-Day War in Israel. And I remember we watched it, some of it on TV, and listened to the radio. And I worked on six bracelets. That summer, before we started to teach in Pittsburgh, we went to New York, and we stopped in Bloomington to visit Eichermann again. And I took her these six bracelets I'd made because I was excited about them, but I didn't know if she would like them or not because she did metals. And she really liked them. And she said, when you get to New York, you must do this. You must make an appointment with Paul Smith, who was then the director of what was then the American Craft Museum. And you must go to the Museum of Modern Art and show those there. And I always tried to do what Eichermann said. Oh, man, I was so scared. But we went to the American Craft Museum, and Paul Smith, I took them in a paper bag, and I pulled them out at his desk. Immediately he stood up, and he walked with a couple into the other room, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this isn't going to work. He doesn't like them. He came back, and he said, oh, we're having a big paper show. And he kept two of them, I think. It was called Made with Paper. It traveled. It was great to be in that.
And what year was this?
Late 60s, 67, I think. And then those pieces got in some other shows, also rejected over the years, but they did get in other shows. I think one was in Zurich even right away in the late 60s.
Oh, great.
It was a nice validation, you know, and I assume I needed that, but I also worked through a lot of years of a lot of rejections. But it was nice to have that validation, especially from Eichermann, but also from Paul Smith. They both were pretty important in helping me. Because he even had said, well, keep me informed of what you're doing. So Jim was starting this research trip, and we got to North Carolina where he was going to do research. And I was going to help him in the library. And he said, let's go to the hardware store. And he bought me a big pair of metal shears and maybe some window screen wire, wheat paste, and I started working in the motel. And they grew bigger. Yeah, I still do paper mache. I like it because I can cover all sorts of things in the understructure. I use hardware cloth. I used to use window screen wire, especially if it had some stiffness to it. Cardboard. So I stitch it together or wire it, drill and wire. And sometimes I've got to add metal pieces for strength on the inside and even soldered elements that I'll wire in. But the paper mache covers all that, so you don't see it, and I don't even remember what's always on the inside. So I like that about it.
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Our guest today is Marjorie Schick, a woman trained in the conventional world of metalsmithing and then took off into wonderful directions of using a variety of materials and a lot of color to express herself quite differently. We return to the conversation as she comments once again on her instructor and mentor, Alma Eichermann, from Indiana University.
It's fun to just watch your face light up as you talk about her, so I'm sure that the whole experience was, as you say, life-changing.
She had great collections of art and flatware and Marimekko clothes. Yeah, she had great style.
And my first memory of you at SNAG conferences was wearing the infamous clock purse, which was, 8 or 10 inches in diameter, clock face that worked. And I was going, whoa, who gets away with doing that? And, you know, now it wouldn't even faze me. But then I thought, this is special.
That was pretty cool. I'd given a workshop in Toronto. There was this wonderful woman who came. She was a a dress designer, fashion designer. This was the second day of the workshop, and I'd given them a quick assignment or something. And this is what she did. I've always remembered. She had white ribbon and paper, and I think she had little wires. And she made this thing that you would tie on around your head, and it had these tiny wires with little cloud shapes of paper up above. And hanging from that were these little ribbons with little cut-out birds that hung just where your mouth is. You'd put that around your head with the clouds up here, and then you'd blow on the ribbons and the birds, and they would fly up in the clouds. I thought it was fabulous. I thought, oh my gosh. I thought, what imagination. She must have told us about some of her clothes, and maybe she mentioned the clock purse. So before I left Toronto, I went to her boutique, and she was the designer of that clock purse. Yes, I bought that purse, and I still have it, and I always had good compliments on it.
And the work that I remember that you were doing at that time was a lot of the painted sticks?
Mm-hmm, the dowel sticks. And even today, if people are going to do a book and they want something, they're always asking for the pieces, those dowel stick pieces from the 80s. Those are the ones that really, I guess, have made the biggest impact. Yeah, I did them maybe from starting about 1982 till about the end of the 80s. And it was just great to, you know, start with one stick. I riveted those together. I didn't know how else to do it, so I drilled all those holes and riveted them, made my own little rivets. And they were pretty experimental. I could make them really large and keep them lightweight. But I always had to worry that the wearer, you know, if it was a big necklace, wouldn't get poked in the eye.
Okay, so papier-mâché. And wooden dowels? Other?
Well, I worked in metal also until the dowels took over about 83. Let's see. I experimented. I kind of floundered a little bit before I found the dowels. So we'll say through the 70s, papier mache, and then I got tired of that. And my wonderful school has a plastics department, so I took plastics as a class one summer. But plastics weren't for me, and I audited maybe a ceramics class and tried some ceramics jewelry, but that wasn't for me. Tried some paper jewelry, too. Paper jewelry with holes pierced in it and threads coming out as the lines. Mm. So after the dowels, late 80s, I started with some plywood. Felt that not just lines, I wanted planes in my work. So started with the plywood, not knowing anything about wood. A colleague had to show me that. That's the way I learned how to work with wood. Then returned to paper mache in the 90s, early 90s. After that, started adding canvas. And so now I kind of do a combination of wood and canvas. Yeah, I've done paper mache sort of within the last year. So I kind of switch around from one to the other.
And with your students, are they learning what they thought maybe when they came in the class would be a conventional jewelry approach? Or are you able to keep all of these other intriguing materials going with them?
Well, beginning class, I think that maybe because of my own training, I think they need to know metals techniques. Basically, I stick to sawing and soldering, drilling, the traditional kinds of things. Now, as they get more advanced, if they wish, I let them incorporate other materials. And I know right now polymer clay is really big. My advanced students did just a little, so we've got to get more into that. And of course we're trying to do some resin jewelry.
Working with the students and then obviously trying to keep your own work going. It's being exhibited still out of the country and in the country, or
Yeah, I'm still exhibiting. I don't gamble, but you know, entering a show is kind of like gambling, isn't it? You're either going to get, you pay your money to try, and then you either get in or you get out. So I don't know, maybe I was in 12 shows last year. And right now, I'm really thrilled because I'm in a show called Unexpected Pleasures. And it's currently at the National Gallery of Victoria down in Australia. And then in August, it's going to move to the Design Museum in London. That's pretty amazing.
That's great. Someone recently was in talking about juried shows and talking about disappointment, sometimes even pain of not getting in.
Oh, yeah.
And his statement was that if you feel like you're always getting rejected from shows, it's because you haven't entered enough of them.
Oh, that's pretty good. And I think there was a year, I'm not sure of this, but I think there was a year I was rejected from 8. I only got in about 3, if that. Well, yeah, I wasn't happy about it, but I kept on going. And it was Paul Dre in Amsterdam who said, oh, that took a lot of self-confidence. And I never thought of it that way. I just thought, oh, probably Iker would say, you better keep on doing it. It's been a good life, so I'm glad I kept at it. But yeah, I mean, you know, I tell students that you can get rejected with one piece and then turn around and it can win a prize in the next show.
Absolutely. I think I've had that happen myself.
So it's been good. And I must say that I owe my husband, Dr. James B. Schick, a huge debt of gratitude. He has given me such a huge amount of support by giving me the time to work, urging me to go here and go there for shows and all of that. I couldn't have done any of it without him. And our son's been a wonderful support as well. Absolutely fabulous.
We often are curious as to how different creative people get through the places when maybe ideas don't seem to come. Do you have little techniques that you use to get you through dry spells? Or?
That's a good question. I do have dry spells. Or I'll start in a direction and then think, oh, that's not right. And I must say that I enjoy having students around, and I hire people to help me because I've kind of worn out my hands over the years, and their advice is good, or I'll say, do you think it's better this way or that way? So that's been a help. You know, even being here at this conference, I've begun to think, oh, you know, when I go back, I'd better start experimenting some. And what I was thinking about today was, I think I've got some canvas here with me, I hope. And I think instead of leaving it flat, I want to start trying to squish it up and forming textures like I did once with paper mache and making a really rough, ragged, jagged sort of form. I need to experiment a bit. I showed with Mobilia Gallery for a very long time in Boston, and they were absolutely wonderful. And they helped me more than they realized because they had all these theme shows. For instance, for teapots. I don't know how many teapot shows they had. So I thought, teapots. So I've done teapots that have rings on their heads that you wear. I did a teapot necklace. I did a teapot that had 10 bracelets on it. I did a teapot that is a bracelet. And then they had a chair show, and I thought, oh, I'd make a small chair for a child. And then I thought, oh, it took me a few weeks to come up. I thought, oh, why didn't I think? Make a wearable chair. So I did a wearable chair that's a really long necklace. It's a yellow ladderback chair. Those theme shows help push me in ways that I probably would never have gone without those.
How do you describe your work?
Well, my book, which we did a couple of years ago, it's Sculpture to Wear, The Jewelry of Marjorie Schick. And I think that is the best description, because it is sculptural, And some of the pieces go beyond the regular, a lot of them go beyond the regular size of jewelry. And so I think sculpture to wear is right. I want them to make us experience the space around us in a new way, because you can't always, well, some of them you couldn't wear in a car or get into the car or walk through the door very easily with them on. So you have to maybe move differently, or if it's a great big armlet, you know you might not be able to rest your arm on your leg the way you might normally without it on. So it makes you more conscious of your own movements, and of course it gives you a new relationship with people who are looking at you, watching, because it's so theatrical, and how you relate to them. And then when it's not worn, which is most of the time, then I hope that it's displayed on the wall or a pedestal as a sculpture. And when I make them, I try to make sure that... Now, we learned from Eichermann that we always had to finish the backs as closely as the fronts, right? So I pretty much designed them in the round so that they work from any angle. And you asked me about having a dry spell. Eichermann used to say, if you can't figure out something new, look at your piece upside down or a new way and start some new drawings, and see if that will guide you to a new piece. Yeah.
I certainly identify with taking care of the back, and I would have to inform my students that it wasn't just the back, as I'm sure Alma Eichermann was doing with you. And there was usually this, well, nobody will see it. And I said, I can't tell you why, but everyone will turn your work over.
It's true.
And they may not say anything, but it's registering.
It's true. It's true. People are always going to look inside, backside, upside down.
So I wish you many more years of doing a lot more of what you're doing, and the colorfulness of it, the humor to some level, and just the sense of fun. And I think that acknowledging that it is sculpture... I mean, I can hope that a small pendant is sculpture, but when it gets to a different size, it certainly takes on that in a whole different way. So I applaud you for all that, and thank you for taking the time to share your story.
Oh, thank you very much. It was my pleasure. I wish you all the best. It was great.
Well, thank you very much.
Our guest today has been Marjorie Schick, an internationally acknowledged creator of sculpture to wear. Trained as a jeweler silversmith, this work, though often not of the conventional metal that you would think of for jewelry, is body adornment. Hope that you'll go on the web and check her out. Again, her last name is spelled S-C-H-I-C-K. Stephen DeLuque and I, Chrissy Hewitt, will be back next week with our tribute to Myron and Priscilla Graham. Not sure that it's going to be possible to state the importance of this couple on the cultural life of this county, but we're going to give it a real try. So, hope you will tune in. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Thank you so much for listening.